How can anything be faulty if there's no such thing as right and wrong?
A thing is only faulty to the degree that it does not function to suit its purpose. If a door does not open and close, you would not call the door wrong. You would merely say its installation or operation is faulty, because it does not serve its purpose. Whatever you construct in your life, in your human society, which does not serve your purpose in becoming human, is faulty. It is a faulty construction.
And just for a review, my purpose in becoming human is...
to decide and to declare, to create and to express, to experience and to fulfill who you really are. To recreate yourself anew in every moment in the grandest version of the greatest vision ever you had about who you really are. That is your purpose in becoming human, and that is the purpose of all life.
So, where does that leave us? We've destroyed religion, we've dissed marriage, we've denounced governments. Where are we, then?
First of all, we've destroyed, dissed, and denounced nothing. If a construction you've created is not working and not producing what you wanted it to produce, to describe that condition is not to destroy, diss, or denounce the construction. Try to remember the difference between judgment and observation.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you here, but a lot of what you've just said has sounded pretty judgmental to me.
We are constricted here by the awful limitation of words. There are really so few of them. And so we have to use the same ones over and over again, even when they don't always convey the same meaning or the same kinds of thoughts. You say that you love banana splits, but you surely don't mean the same thing as when you say you love each other. So you see, you have very few words, really, to describe how you're feeling. In communicating with you in this way, in the way of words, I've allowed myself to experience those limitations. And I will concede that because some of this language has also been used by you when you are being judgmental, it would be easy to conclude that I'm being judgmental when I use them. Let me assure you here that I am not. Throughout this whole dialogue, I have simply been trying to tell you how to get where you say you want to go, and to describe as impactfully as possible what is blocking your way, what is stopping you from going there. Now, with regard to religion, you say where you want to go is to a place where you can truly know God and love God. I'm simply observing that your religions do not take you there. Your religions have made God the great mystery and caused you not to love God, but to fear God. Religion has done little as well to cause you to change your behaviors. You're still killing each other, condemning each other, making each other wrong. And in fact, it is your religions which have been encouraging you to do so. So with regard to religion, I merely observe that you say you want it to take you to one place and it is taking you to another. Now you say you want marriage to take you to the land of eternal bliss, or at least to some reasonable level of peace, security, and happiness. As with religion, your invention called marriage does well with this in the early going when you are first experiencing it. Yet as with religion, the longer you reside in the experience, the more it takes you where you say you don't want to go. Nearly half of the people who become married dissolve their marriage through divorce, and of those who stay married, many are desperately unhappy. Your unions of bliss lead you to bitterness, anger, and regret. Some, and not a small number, take you to a place of outright tragedy. You say you want your governments to ensure peace, freedom, and domestic tranquility, and I observe that as you have devised them, they do none of this. Rather, your governments lead you to war, increasing lack of freedom, and domestic violence and upheaval. You haven't been able to solve the basic problems of simply feeding and keeping people healthy and alive, much less meet the challenge of providing them with equal opportunity. Hundreds of you die every day of starvation on a planet where thousands of you throw away each day enough food to feed nations. You can't handle the simplest task of getting the leftovers from the haves to the have-nots, much less resolve the issue of whether you even want to share your resources more equitably. But these are not judgments. These are things which are observably true about your society.
Why? Why? Why is it like this? Why have we made so little progress in conducting our own affairs these past many years?
Years? Try centuries.
Okay, centuries.
It has to do with the first human cultural myth, and with all the other myths which necessarily follow. Until they change, nothing else will change. For your cultural myths inform your ethics, and your ethics create your behaviors. Yet the problem is that your cultural myth is at variance with your basic instinct.
What do you mean?
Your first cultural myth is that human beings are inherently evil. This is the myth of original sin. The myth holds that not only is your basic nature evil, you were born that way. The second cultural myth, arising necessarily out of the first, is that it is the fittest who survive. The second myth holds that some of you are strong and some of you are weak, and that to survive, you have to be one of the strong. You will do all that you can to help your fellow man, but if and when it comes down to your own survival, you will take care of yourself first. You will even let others die. Indeed, you will go further than that. If you think you have to, in order for you and yours to survive, you will actually kill others, presumably the weak, thereby defining you as the fittest. Some of you say that this is your basic instinct. It is called the survival instinct. And it is this cultural myth that has formed much of your societal ethic, creating many of your group behaviors. Yet your basic instinct is not survival, but rather fairness, oneness, and love. This is the basic instinct of all sentient beings everywhere. It is your cellular memory. It is your inherent nature. Thus has exploded your first cultural myth. You are not basically evil. You are not born in original sin. If your basic instinct was survival, and if your basic nature was evil, you would never move instinctively to save a child from falling, a man from drowning, or anyone from anything. And yet, when you act on your basic instincts and display your basic nature and don't think about what you are doing, this is exactly how you behave, even at your own peril. Thus, your basic instinct cannot be survival, and your basic nature is clearly not evil. Your instinct and your nature is to reflect the essence of who you are, which is fairness, oneness, and love. Looking at the social implications of this, it is important to understand the difference between fairness and equality. It is not a basic instinct of all sentient beings to seek equality or to be equal. Indeed, exactly the opposite is true. The basic instinct of all living things is to express uniqueness, not sameness. Creating a society in which two beings are truly equal is not only impossible, but undesirable. Societal mechanisms seeking to produce true equality, in other words, economic, political, and social sameness, work against, not for, the grandest idea and the highest purpose, which is that each being will have the opportunity to produce the outcome of its grandest desire, and thus truly recreate itself anew. Equality of opportunity is what is required for this, not equality in fact. This is called fairness. Equality in fact, produced by exterior forces and laws, would eliminate, not produce, fairness. It would eliminate the opportunity for true self-recreation, which is the highest goal of enlightened beings everywhere. And what would create freedom of opportunity? Systems that would allow society to meet the basic survival needs of every individual, freeing all beings to pursue self-development and self-creation rather than self-survival. In other words, systems that imitate the true system called life, in which survival is guaranteed. Now, because self-survival is not an issue in enlightened societies, these societies would never allow one of its members to suffer if there were enough for all. In these societies, self-interest and mutual best interest are identical. No society created around a myth of inherent evilness or survival of the fittest could possibly achieve such understanding.
Yes, I see this, and this cultural myth question is something I want to explore along with the behaviors and ethics of more advanced civilizations later in greater detail. But I'd like to double back one last time and resolve the questions I started off with here. One of the challenges of talking with you is that your answers lead us in such interesting directions, I sometimes forget where I began. But in this case, I haven't. We were discussing marriage, and we were discussing love and its requirements.
Well, love has no requirements. That's what makes it love. If your love for another carries requirements, then it's not love at all, but some counterfeit version. That is what I've been trying to tell you here. It is what I have been saying in a dozen different ways with every question you've asked here. Within the context of marriage, for example, there is an exchange of vows that love does not require. Yet you require them because you do not know what love is, and so you make each other promise what love would never ask.
Then you are against marriage.
I am against nothing. I am simply describing what I see. You can redesign your social construction called marriage so that it does not ask what love would never ask, but rather declares what only love could declare.
In other words, change the marriage vows.
More than that. Change the expectations on which the vows are based. These expectations are going to be difficult to change because they are your cultural heritage. They arise, in turn, from your cultural myths.
Here we go again with the cultural myths routine. What's up with you about this?
I'm hoping to point you in the right direction here. I see where you say you want to go with your society, and I am hoping to find human words and human terms that can direct you there. May I give you an example?
Please.
One of your cultural myths about love is that it's about giving rather than receiving. This has become a cultural imperative, and yet it is driving you crazy and causing more damage than you could ever imagine. It gets and keeps people in bad marriages. It causes relationships of all kinds to be dysfunctional. Yet no one, not your parents to whom you look for guidance, not your clergy to whom you look for inspiration, not your psychologists and psychiatrists to whom you look for clarity, not even your artists and writers to whom you look for intellectual leadership, will dare to challenge the prevailing cultural myth. And so, songs are written, stories are told, movies are made, guidance is given, prayers are offered, and parenting is done which perpetuates the myth. Then you are all left to live up to it. And you can't. Yet it is not you that is the problem. It is the myth.
Love is not about giving rather than receiving?
No.
It isn't?
No, it never has been.
But you said yourself just a moment ago that love has no requirements. You said that's what makes it love.
And so it is.
Well, that sure sounds like giving rather than receiving to me.
Then you need to reread chapter 8 of book 1. Everything I'm alluding to here, I've explained to you there. This dialogue was meant to be read in sequence and to be considered as a whole.
I know, but for those who nevertheless came to these words now without having read Book 1, could you explain, please, what you're getting at here? Because, frankly, even I could use the review, and I think I now understand this stuff.
Okay, here goes. Everything you do for yourself. This is true because you and all others are one. What you do for another, you therefore do for you. What you fail to do for another, you fail to do for you. What is good for another is good for you. And what is bad for another is bad for you. This is the most basic truth. Yet it is the truth you most frequently ignore. Now, when you are in a relationship with another, that relationship has only one purpose. It exists as a vehicle for you to decide and to declare, to create and to express, to experience and to fulfill your highest notion of who you really are. Now, if who you really are is a person who is kind and considerate, caring and sharing, compassionate and loving, then when you are being these things with others, you are giving yourself the grandest experience for which you came into the body. This is why you took a body, because only in the physical realm of the relative could you know yourself as these things. In the realm of the absolute from which you have come, this experience of knowing is impossible. All these things I've explained to you in far greater detail in Book 1. Now, if who you really are is a being who does not love the self and who allows the self to be abused, damaged, and destroyed by others, then you will continue behaviors which allow you to experience that. Yet if you really are a person who is kind and considerate, caring and sharing, compassionate and loving, you will include yourself among the people with whom you are being these things. Indeed, you will start with yourself. You will put yourself first in these matters. Everything in life depends on what you are seeking to be. If, for instance, you are seeking to be one with all others, that is, if you are seeking to experience a conceptualization you already know to be true, you will find yourself behaving in a very specific way. a way which allows you to experience and demonstrate your oneness. And when you do certain things as a result of this, you will not experience that you are doing something for someone else, but rather that you are doing it for yourself. The same will be true no matter what you are seeking to be. If you are seeking to be love, you will do loving things with others, not for others, but with others. Notice the difference. Catch the nuance. You will be doing loving things with others, for yourself, so that you can actualize and experience your grandest idea about yourself and who you really are. In this sense, it is impossible to do anything for another, for every act of your own volition is literally just that, an act. You are acting, that is, creating and playing a role, except you are not pretending. You are actually being it. You are a human being, and what you are being is decided and chosen by you. Your Shakespeare said it, all the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. He also said, to be or not to be, that is the question. And he also said, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. When you are true to yourself, when you do not betray yourself, then when it looks like you are giving, you will know you are actually receiving. You are literally giving yourself back to yourself. You cannot truly give to another for the simple reason that there is no other. If we are all one, then there is only you.
You know, this sometimes seems like a semantic trick, a way to change the words around, to alter their meaning.
It's not a trick, but it is magic. And it's not about changing words to alter meaning, but changing perceptions to alter experience. Your experience of everything is based on your perceptions, and your perception is based on your understanding, and your understanding is based on your myths, that is, on what you have been told. Now, I tell you this, your present cultural myths have not served you. They have not taken you where you say you want to go. Either you are lying to yourself about where you say you want to go, or you are blind to the fact that you're not getting there. Not as an individual, not as a country, not as a species or a race.
Are there other species which are?
Oh, yes, decidedly.
Okay, I've waited long enough. Now tell me about them.
Soon, very soon. But first I want to tell you about how you can alter your invention called marriage so that it takes you closer to where you say you want to go. Do not destroy it. Do not do away with it. Alter it.
Yes, well, I do want to know about that. I do want to know whether there is any way that human beings will ever be allowed to express true love. So I end this section of our dialogue where I began it, I guess. What limits shall we, indeed, what limits, some would say, must we, place on that expression?
None. No limits at all. And that is what your marriage vows should state.
That's amazing. Because that's exactly what my marriage vows with Nancy did state.
I know.
When Nancy and I decided to get married, I suddenly felt inspired to write a whole new set of marriage vows.
I know.
And Nancy joined me. She agreed that we couldn't possibly exchange the vows that had become traditional at weddings.
I know.
We sat down and created new marriage vows that, well, that defied the cultural imperative, as you might put it.
Yes, you did. I was very proud.
And as we were writing them, as we put the vows down on paper for the minister to read, I truly believe we were both inspired.
Of course you were.
Do you mean that?
What do you think? I only come to you when you're writing books.
Wow.
Yes, wow. So why don't you put those marriage vows here?
Huh?
Go ahead. You've got a copy of them. Put them right here.
Well, we didn't create them to share with the world.
When this dialogue began, you didn't think any of it would be shared with the world. Go ahead. Put them in.
Well, it's just that I don't want people to think that I'm saying we've written the perfect marriage vows.
All of a sudden you're worried about what people will think?
Come on, you know what I mean.
Look, no one says these are the perfect marriage vows.
Well, okay.
They're just the best anyone on your planet's come up with so far.
Hey!
Just kidding. Let's lighten up here, huh? Go ahead, put the vows in. I'll take responsibility for them. And people will love them. It'll give them an idea of what we're talking about here. Why, you may even want to invite others to take these vows, which are not really vows at all, but marriage statements.
Well, okay. Here's what Nancy and I said to each other when we got married, thanks to the inspiration we received. Why don't you be the minister?
Okay. Neil and Nancy have not come here tonight to make a solemn promise or to exchange a sacred vow. Nancy and Neil have come here to make public their love for each other, to give notice to their truth, to declare their choice to live and partner and grow together, out loud and in your presence, out of their desire that we will all come to feel a very real and intimate part of their decision, and thus make it even more powerful. They've also come here tonight in the further hope that their ritual of bonding will help bring us all closer together. If you are here tonight with a spouse or a partner, let this ceremony be a reminder, a rededication of your own loving bond. We'll begin by asking the question, why get married? Neil and Nancy have answered this question for themselves, and they've told me their answer. Now, I want to ask them one more time so that they can be sure of their answer, certain of their understanding, and firm in their commitment to the truth they share.
And here the minister gets two red roses from the table.
This is the ceremony of roses, in which Nancy and Neil share their understandings and commemorate that sharing. Now, Nancy and Neil, you have told me it is your firm understanding that you are not entering into this marriage for reasons of security, that the only real security is not in owning or possessing, nor in being owned or possessed, not in demanding or expecting, and not even in hoping that what you think you need in life will be supplied by the other, but rather in knowing that everything you need in life, all the love, all the wisdom, all the insight, all the power, all the knowledge, all the understanding, all the nurturing, all the compassion, and all the strength resides within you. And that you are not each marrying the other in hopes of getting these things, but in hopes of giving these gifts, that the other might have them in even greater abundance. Is that your firm understanding tonight?
It is.
And Neil and Nancy, you have told me it is your firm understanding you are not entering into this marriage as a means of in any way limiting, controlling, hindering, or restricting each other from any true expression and honest celebration of that which is the highest and best within you, including your love of God, your love of life, your love of people, your love of creativity, your love of work, or any aspect of your being which genuinely represents you and brings you joy. Is that still your firm understanding tonight?
It is.
Finally, Nancy and Neil, you have said to me that you do not see marriage as producing obligations, but rather as providing opportunities, opportunities for growth, for full self-expression, for lifting your lives to their highest potential, for healing every false thought or small idea you ever had about yourself, and for ultimate reunion with God through the communion of your two souls. That this is truly a holy communion, a journey through life with one you love as an equal partner, sharing equally both the authority and the responsibilities inherent in any partnership, bearing equally what burdens there be, basking equally in the glories. Is that the vision you wish to enter into now?
It is.
I now give you these red roses, symbolizing your individual understandings of these earthly things, that you both know and agree how life will be with you in bodily form and within the physical structure called marriage. Give these roses now to each other as a symbol of your sharing of these agreements and understandings with love. Now please, each of you take this white rose. It is a symbol of your larger understandings, of your spiritual nature, and your spiritual truth. It stands for the purity of your real and highest self, and of the purity of God's love, which shines upon you now and always.
And here the minister gives Nancy the rose with my ring on the stem and gives me the rose with Nancy's ring on it.
What symbols do you bring as a reminder of the promises given and received today?
We each remove the rings from the stems, giving them to the minister who holds them in her hand as she says,
a circle is the symbol of the sun and the earth and the universe. It is a symbol of holiness and of perfection and peace. It is also the symbol of the eternality of spiritual truth, love, and life, that which has no beginning and no end. And in this moment, Neil and Nancy choose for it to also be a symbol of unity, but not of possession, of joining, but not of restricting, of encirclement, but not of entrapment. For love cannot be possessed, nor can it be restricted, and the soul can never be entrapped. Now, Neil and Nancy, please take these rings you wish to give one to the other. Neil, please repeat after me. I, Neil,
ask you, Nancy,
to be my partner, my lover, my friend, and my wife.
To be my partner, my lover, my friend, and my wife.
I announce and declare my intention to give you my deepest friendship and love.
I announce and declare my intention to give you my deepest friendship and love.
Not only when your moments are high.
Not only when your moments are high.
But when they are low.
But when they are low.
Not only when you remember clearly who you are.
Not only when you remember clearly who you are.
But when you forget.
But when you forget.
Not only when you are acting with love.
Not only when you are acting with love.
But when you are not.
But when you are not.
I further announce. Before God and those here present.
Before God and those here present.
That I will seek always to see the light of divinity within you.
That I will seek always to see the light of divinity within you.
And seek always to share.
And seek always to share.
The light of divinity within me.
The light of divinity within me.
Even and especially.
Even and especially.
In whatever moments of darkness may come.
In whatever moments of darkness may come.
It is my intention to be with you forever.
It is my intention to be with you forever.
In a holy partnership of the soul.
In a holy partnership of the soul.
That we may do together God's work.
That we may do together God's work.
Sharing all that is good within us.
Sharing all that is good within us.
With all those whose lives we touch.
Within all those whose lives we touch.
Nancy, do you choose to grant Neil's request that you be his wife?
I do.
Now, Nancy, please repeat after me. I, Nancy,
ask you, Neil,
to be my partner, my lover, my friend, and my husband.
To be my partner, my lover, my friend, and my husband.
I announce and declare my intention to give you my deepest friendship and love.
I announce and declare my intention to give you my deepest friendship and love.
Not only when your moments are high.
Not only when your moments are high.
But when they are low.
But when they are low.
Not only when you remember clearly who you are.
Not only when you remember clearly who you are.
But when you forget.
But when you forget.
Not only when you are acting with love.
Not only when you are acting with love.
But when you are not.
But when you are not.
I further announce,
before God and those here present,
that I will seek always to see the light of divinity within you.
That I will seek always to see the light of divinity within you.
And seek always to share, the light of divinity within me.
The light of divinity within me.
Even and especially, in whatever moments of darkness may come.
In whatever moments of darkness may come.
It is my intention to be with you forever.
It is my intention to be with you forever.
In a holy partnership of the soul.
In a holy partnership of the soul.
That we may do together God's work.
That we may do together God's work.
Sharing all that is good within us.
Sharing all that is good within us.
With all those whose lives we touch.
With all those whose lives we touch.
Neil, do you choose to grant Nancy's request that you be her husband?
I do.
Please then, both of you, take hold of the rings you would give each other and repeat after me. With this ring.
With this ring.
With this ring.
I thee wed.
I thee wed.
I take now the ring you give me.
I take now the ring you give me.
And give it place upon my hand.
And give it place upon my hand.
That all may see and know.
That all may see and know.
Of my love for you.
Of my love for you.
We recognize with full awareness that only a couple can administer the sacrament of marriage to each other. And only a couple can sanctify it. Neither my church nor any power vested in me by the state can grant me the authority to declare what only two hearts can declare. And what only two souls can make real. And so now, inasmuch as you, Nancy, and you, Neil, have announced the truths that are already written in your hearts, and have witnessed the same in the presence of these your friends and the one living Spirit. We observe joyfully that you have declared yourself to be husband and wife. Let us now join in prayer. Spirit of love and life, out of this whole world, two souls have found each other. Their destinies shall now be woven into one design, and their perils and their joys shall not be known apart. Neil and Nancy, may your home be a place of happiness for all who enter it, a place where the old and the young are renewed in each other's company, a place for growing and a place for sharing, a place for music and a place for laughter, a place for prayer and a place for love. May those who are nearest to you be constantly enriched by the beauty and the bounty of your love for one another. May your work be a joy of your life that serves the world. And may your days be good and long upon the earth. Amen. And amen.
I'm so touched by that. I'm so honored, so blessed to have found someone in my life who could say those words with me and mean them. Dear God, thank you for sending me Nancy.
You're a gift to her, too, you know.
I hope so.
Trust me.
You know what I wish?
No, what?
I wish that all people could make those marriage statements. I wish people could cut them out or copy them and use them for their wedding. I bet we'd see the divorce rate plummet.
Some people would have a very hard time saying those vows, and many would have a hard time staying true to them.
I just hope that we can stay true to them. I mean, the problem with putting those words here is that now we have to live up to them.
You are not planning on living up to them?
Well, of course we were, but we're human, just like everybody else. Yet now if we fail, if we falter, if anything should happen to our relationship, or good grief if we should ever choose to end it in its present form, all kinds of people are going to be disillusioned.
Nonsense. They'll know that you're being true to yourself. They'll know that you have made a later choice, a new choice. Remember what I told you in Book One? Do not confuse the length of your relationship with its quality. You're not an icon, and neither is Nancy. And no one should put you there, and you should not put yourself there. Just be human. Just be fully human. If at some later point you and Nancy feel you wish to reform your relationship in a different way, you have a perfect right to do that. That is the point of this whole dialogue.
And it was the point of the statements we made.
Exactly. I'm glad that you see that.
Yes, I like those marriage statements. And I'm glad we put them in. It's a wonderful new way to begin a life together. No more asking the woman to promise to love, honor, and obey. It was self-righteous, self-inflated, self-serving men who demanded that.
Right, of course.
And it was even more self-righteous and self-serving for men to claim that such male preeminence was God-ordained.
Again, you are right. I never ordained any such thing.
At last, marriage words which really are inspired by God. Words which make a chattel personal property out of no one. Words which speak the truth about love. Words which place no limitations but promise only freedom. Words to which all hearts can remain true.
There are those who will say, of course, anyone can keep vows which ask nothing of you. What will you say to that?
I will say it is much more difficult to free someone than to control them. When you control someone, you get what you want. When you free someone, they get what they want.
You will have spoken wisely.
I have a wonderful idea. I think we should make a little booklet out of those marriage statements, kind of a little prayer book for people to use on their wedding day. Could be a small little book. It would contain not only those words, but a whole ceremony and key observations about love and relationship from all three books in this dialogue, as well as some special prayers or meditations on marriage, which it turns out you're not against. I'm so happy because it started to sound for a minute as if you were anti-marriage.
How can I be against marriage? We are all married. We are married to each other now and forevermore. We are united. We are one. Ours is the biggest marriage ceremony ever held. My vow to you is the grandest vow ever made. I will love you forever and free you for everything. My love will never bind you in any way, and because of this, you are bound to love me, for freedom to be who you are is your greatest desire and my greatest gift. Do you take me now to be your lawfully wedded partner and co-creator according to the highest laws of the universe?
I do. And do you take me now as your partner and co-creator?
I do, and I always have. now and through all eternity, we are one. Amen.
And amen. When does the soul join the body?
When do you think?
When it chooses to.
Good.
But people want a more definitive answer. They want to know when life begins, life as they know it.
I understand.
So what is the signal? Is it the emergence of the body from the womb, the physical birth? Is it the moment of conception, the physical joining of the elements of physical life?
Life has no beginning because life has no end, merely extends, creates new forms.
It must be like that globby material in those heated lava lamps that were so popular in the 60s. Remember that? The globs would lay in big, soft, round balls at the bottom, then rise from the heat, separating and forming new globs, shaping themselves as they rose, rejoining each other at the top, cascading together to form even larger globs of the all, and starting all over again. There were never any new globs in the tubes. It was all the same stuff, reforming itself into what looked like new and different stuff. The varieties were endless. It was fascinating to watch the process unfold over and over again.
That's a great metaphor. That's how it is with souls. The one soul, which is really all there is, reforms itself into smaller and smaller parts of itself. All the parts were there at the beginning. There are no new parts, merely portions of the all that always was, reforming itself into what looks like new and different parts.
There's a brilliant pop song written and performed by Joan Osborne that asks, "What if God were one of us, just a slob like one of us?" I'm going to have to ask her to change the lyric line to, "What if God was one of us, just a glob like one of us?"
Ah, that's very good. And you know, her song was a brilliant song. It pushed people's buttons all over the place. People couldn't stand the thought that I am no better than one of them.
That reaction is an interesting comment, not so much on God, but on the human race. If we consider it a blasphemy for God to be compared to one of us, what does that say about us?
What indeed?
Yet you are one of us. That's exactly what you've been saying here. So Joan was right.
She certainly was, profoundly right.
Well, I want to get back to my question. Can you tell us anything about when life as we know it starts? At what point does the soul enter the body?
The soul doesn't enter the body. The body is enveloped by the soul. Remember what I said before? The body does not house the soul. It is the other way around. Everything is always alive. There is no such thing as dead. There is no such state of being. That which is always alive simply shapes itself into a new form, a new physical form. That form is charged with living energy, the energy of life, always. Life, if you are calling life the energy that I am, is always there. It is never not there. Life never ends. So how can there be a point when life begins?
Come on, help me out here. You know what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, I do. You want me to enter the abortion debate.
Yes, I do. I admit it. I mean, I've got God here, and I have a chance to ask the monumental question. When does life begin?
And the answer is so monumental you can't hear it.
Try me again.
It never begins. Life never begins. Because life never ends. You want to get into biological technicalities so that you can make up a rule based on what you want to call God's law about how people should behave, then punish them if they do not behave that way.
What's wrong with that? That would allow us to kill doctors in the parking lots of clinics with impunity.
Yes, I understand. You have used me and what you have declared to be my laws as justification for all sorts of things through the years.
Oh, come on. Why won't you just say that terminating a pregnancy is murder?
You cannot kill anyone or anything.
No, but you can end its individuation, and in our language, that's killing.
You cannot stop the process wherein which a part of me individually expresses in a certain way without the part of me that is expressing in that way agreeing.
What? What are you saying?
I am saying that nothing happens against the will of God. Life and all that is occurring is an expression of God's will. Read that, your will. Made manifest. I have said in this dialogue, your will is my will. That is because there is only one of us. Life is God's will, expressing perfectly. If something was happening against God's will, it couldn't happen. By definition of who and what God is, it couldn't happen. Do you believe that one soul can somehow decide something for another? Do you believe that as individuals you can affect each other in ways in which the other does not want to be affected? Such a belief would have to be based on the idea that you are separate from each other. Do you believe that you can somehow affect life in a way in which God does not want life to be affected? Such a belief would have to be based on an idea that you are separate from me. Both ideas are false. It is arrogant beyond measure for you to believe that you can affect the universe in a way with which the universe does not agree.
You are dealing with mighty forces here, and some of you believe that you are mightier than the mightiest force. Yet you are not, nor are you less mighty than the mightiest force. You are the mightiest force. No more, no less. So let the force be with you.
Are you saying that I can't kill anybody without his or her permission? Are you telling me that at some higher level, everyone who has ever been killed has agreed to be killed?
You are looking at things in earthly terms and thinking of things in earthly terms, and none of this is going to make sense to you.
I can't help thinking in earthly terms. I am here, right now, on the earth.
I tell you this. You are in this world, but not of it.
So my earthly reality is not reality at all?
Did you really think it was?
I don't know.
You've never thought there's something larger going on here?
Well, yes, sure I have.
Well, this is what's going on. I'm explaining it to you.
Okay. Okay, I got it. So that means I guess I can just go out and kill anybody because I couldn't have done it anyway if they hadn't agreed.
In fact, the human race acts that way. It's interesting that you're having such a hard time with this, yet you're going around acting as if it were true anyway. Or worse yet, you are killing people against their will as if it didn't matter.
Well, of course it matters. It's just that what we want matters more. Don't you get it? In the moment we humans kill somebody, we're not saying that the fact that we've done that doesn't matter. It would be flippant to think that. It's just that what we want matters more.
I see. So it's easier for you to accept that it's okay to kill others against their will. This you can do with impunity. It's doing it because it is their will that you feel is wrong.
I never said that. That's not how humans think.
It isn't? Let me show you how hypocritical some of you are. You say it is okay to kill somebody against their will so long as you have a good and sufficient reason for wanting them dead, as in war, for instance, or an execution, or a doctor in the parking lot of an abortion clinic. Yet if the other person feels they have a good and sufficient reason for wanting themselves dead, you may not help them die. That would be assisted suicide, and that would be wrong.
Now you're making mock of me.
No. You are making mock of me. You are saying that I would condone your killing someone against his will, and that I would condemn your killing someone in accordance with his will. This is insane. Still, you not only fail to see the insanity, you actually claim that those who point out the insanity are the ones who are crazy. You are the ones who have your head on straight. And they are just... Now, this is the kind of tortured logic with which you construct entire lives and complete theologies.
I never looked at it quite that way.
I tell you this, the time has come for you to look at things a new way. This is the moment of your rebirth, as an individual and as a society. You must recreate your world now before you destroy it with your insanities. Now listen to me. We are all one. There is only one of us. You are not separate from me, and you are not separate from each other. Everything we are doing in concert with each other. Our reality is a co-created reality. If you terminate a pregnancy, we terminate a pregnancy. Your will is my will. No individual aspect of divinity has power over any other aspect of divinity. It is not possible for one soul to affect another against its will. There are no victims and there are no villains. You cannot understand this from your limited perspective, but I am telling you it is so. There's only one reason to be, do, or have anything, as a direct statement of who you are. If who you are, as an individual and as a society, is who you choose and desire to be, there's no reason to change anything. If, on the other hand, you believe there's a grander experience waiting to be had, an even greater expression of divinity than the one currently manifesting, then move into that truth. Since all of us are co-creating, it may serve us to do what we can to show others the way that some parts of us wish to go. You can be a way-shower, demonstrating the life that you'd like to create, and inviting others to follow your example. You might even say, I am the life and the way. Follow me. But be careful. Some people have been crucified for making such statements.
Thank you. I'll heed the warning. I'll keep a low profile.
I can see that you're doing a real good job of that.
Well, when you say you're having a conversation with God, it's not easy to keep a low profile.
As others have discovered.
Which might be a good reason for me to keep my mouth shut.
It's a little late for that.
Well, whose fault is that?
I see what you mean.
It's okay. I forgive you.
You do?
Yes.
How can you forgive me?
Because I can understand why you did it. I understand why you came to me, started this dialogue. And when I understand why something was done, I can forgive all the complications that it may have caused or created.
Well, that's interesting. Would that you could think of God as being so magnificent as you.
Touché.
You have an unusual relationship with me. In some ways you think you could never be as magnificent as me. And in other ways you think I cannot be as magnificent as you. Don't you find that interesting?
Fascinating.
Because you think we are separated. These imaginings would leave you if you thought that we were one. This is the main difference between your culture, which is a baby culture, really, a primitive culture, and the highly evolved cultures of the universe. The most significant difference is that in highly evolved cultures, all sentient beings are clear that there is no separation between themselves and what you call God.
They are also clear that there is no separation between themselves and others. They know that they are each having an individual experience of the whole.
Oh, good. Now you're going to get into the highly evolved societies of the universe. I've been waiting for this.
Yes, I think it's time we explored that.
But before we do, I simply must return one last time to the abortion issue. You're not saying here, are you, that because nothing can happen to the human soul against its will, it's okay to kill people? You're not condoning abortion or giving us a way out on this issue, are you?
I'm neither condoning nor condemning abortion, any more than I condone or condemn war. The people of every country think I condone the war they are fighting and condemn the war that their opponent is fighting. The people of every nation believe they have God on their side. Every cause assumes the same thing. Indeed, every person feels the same thing, or at least hopes it is true whenever any decision or choice is made. And do you know why all creatures believe God is on their side? Because I am. And all creatures have an intuitive knowing of this. This is just another way of saying, your will for you is my will for you. And that is just another way of saying, I have given you all free will. There is no free will if to exercise it in certain ways produces punishment. That makes a mockery of free will and renders it counterfeit. So with regard to abortion or war, buying that car or marrying that person or having sex or not having sex, doing your duty or not doing your duty, there is no such thing as right or wrong, and I have no preference in the matter. You are all in the process of defining yourselves. Every act is an act of self-definition. If you are pleased with how you have created yourself, if it serves you, you will continue doing so in that way. If you are not, you will stop. This is called evolution. The process is slow because as you evolve, you keep changing your ideas about what really serves you. You keep changing your concepts of pleasure. Remember what I said earlier? You can tell how highly a person or society has evolved by what that being or society calls pleasure. And I will add here, by what it declares to serve it. If it serves you to go to war and kill other beings, you will do so. If it serves you to terminate a pregnancy, you will do so. The only thing that changes as you evolve is your idea of what serves you. And that is based on what you think you are trying to do. If you are trying to get to Seattle, it will not serve you to head toward San Jose. It is not morally wrong to go to San Jose. It simply doesn't serve you. The question of what you are trying to do then becomes a question of prime importance, not just in your life in general, but in every moment of your life specifically. Because it is in the moments of life that a life itself is created. All of this was covered in great detail in the beginning of our holy dialogue, which you have come to call Book One. I'm repeating it here because you seem to need a reminder, or you would never have asked me your question on abortion. When you are preparing to have your abortion, therefore, or when you are preparing to smoke that cigarette, or when you are preparing to fry and eat that animal, and when you are preparing to cut that man off in traffic, whether the matter is large or small, whether the choice is major or minor, there is only one question to consider. Is this who I really am? Is this who I now choose to be? And understand this, no matter is inconsequential. There is a consequence to everything. The consequence is who and what you are. You are in the act of defining yourself right now. That is your answer to the abortion question. That is your answer to the war question. That is your answer to the smoking question and the meat-eating question and to every question about behavior you've ever had. Every act is an act of self-definition. Everything you think, say, and do declares, this is who I am. I want to tell you, my dearest children, that this matter of who you are and who you choose to be is of great importance, not only because it sets the tone of your experience, but because it creates the nature of mine. All of your life you have been told that God created you. I come now to tell you this. You are creating God. That is a massive rearrangement of your understanding, I know. And yet it is a necessary one if you are to go about the true work for which you came. This is holy work we are up to, you and I. This is sacred ground we walk. This is the path. In every moment, God expresses himself in, as, and through you. You are always at choice as to how God will be created now, and I will never take that choice from you, nor will I punish you for making the wrong choice. Yet you are not without guidance in these matters, nor will you ever be. Built into you is an internal guidance system that shows you the way home. This is the voice that speaks to you always of your highest choice, that places before you your grandest vision. All you need do is heed that voice and not abandon the vision. Throughout your history, I've sent you teachers. During every day and time have my messengers brought you glad tidings of great joy. Holy scriptures have been written and holy lives have been lived, that you might know of this eternal truth, you and I are one. Now again I send you scriptures. You are writing them right now. Now again I send you messengers seeking to bring you the word of God. Will you listen to these words? Will you hear these messengers? Will you become one of them? That is the great question. That is the grand invitation. That is the glorious decision. The world awaits your announcement. And you make that announcement with your life lived. The human race has no chance to lift itself from its own lowest thoughts until you lift yourself to your own highest ideas. Those ideas expressed through you, as you create the template, set the stage, serve as a model for the next level of human experience. You are the life and the way. The world will follow you. You are not at choice in this matter. It is the only matter in which you have no free choice. It is simply the way it is. Your world will follow your idea about yourself. Ever it has been, ever it will be. First comes your thought about yourself, then follows the outer world of physical manifestation. What you think, you create. What you create, you become. What you become, you express. What you express, you experience. What you experience, you are. What you are, you think. The circle is complete. The holy work in which you are engaged has really just begun, for now at last you understand what you are doing. It is you who have caused yourself to know this. You who have caused yourself to care. And you do care now, more than ever before, about who you really are. For now at last you see the whole picture. Who you are, I am. You are defining God. I have sent you a blessed part of me into physical form that I might know myself experientially as all that I know myself to be conceptually. Life exists as a tool for God to turn concept into experience. It exists for you to do the same, for you are God doing this. I choose to recreate myself anew in every single moment. I choose to experience the grandest version of the greatest vision ever I had about who I am. I have created you so that you might recreate me. This is our holy work. This is our greatest joy. This is our very reason for being.
You know, I'm filled with awe and reverence at the reading of those words. Thanks for being here with me in this way. Thanks for being here with all of us.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here for me.
I've just got a few remaining questions, some having to do with those evolved beings, and then I'm going to allow myself to finish this dialogue.
My beloved, you will never finish this dialogue, nor will you ever have to. Your conversation with God will go on forever. And now that you're actively engaged in it, that conversation will soon lead to friendship. All good conversations eventually lead to friendship, and soon your conversation with God will produce a friendship with God.
You know, I feel that. I feel that we've actually become friends.
And, as happens in all relationships, that friendship, if it is nurtured, kindled, and allowed to grow, will produce, at last, a sense of communion. You will feel and experience yourself as being in communion with God. This will be a holy communion, for then we will speak as one.
So this dialogue will continue then?
Yes, always.
And I won't have to say goodbye at the end of this book.
You never have to say goodbye. You only have to say hello.
You're marvelous. Do you know that? You're simply marvelous.
And so are you, my son, and so are you, as are all my children everywhere.
Say, do you have children everywhere?
Of course.
No. I mean literally everywhere. I mean, is there life on other planets? Are your children elsewhere in the universe?
Again, of course.
Are these civilizations more advanced?
Some of them, yes.
In what way?
In every way. Technologically, politically, socially, spiritually, physically, and psychologically. For instance, your penchant for, your insistence upon comparisons, and your constant need to characterize something as better or worse, higher or lower, good or bad, demonstrates how far into duality you have fallen, how deeply into separatism you have submerged.
In more advanced civilizations, you do not observe these characteristics? And what do you mean, by the way, by duality?
The level of a society's advancement is reflected inevitably in the degree of its duality thinking. Social evolution is demonstrated by movement toward unity, not separatism.
Why? Why is unity such a yardstick?
Because unity is the truth. Separatism is the illusion. As long as a society sees itself as separate, a series or collection of separate units, it lives in the illusion. All of life on your planet is built on separatism, based in duality. You imagine yourselves to be separate families or clans, gathered in separate neighborhoods or states, collected in separate nations or countries, comprising a separate world or planet. You imagine your world to be the only inhabited world in the universe. You imagine your nation to be the finest nation on earth. You imagine your state to be the best state in the nation, and your family the most wonderful in the state. Finally, you think that you are better than anyone else in your family. Oh, you claim you don't think any of this, but you act as if you do. Your true thoughts are reflected every day in your social decisions, your political conclusions, your religious determinations, your economic choices, and your individual selections of everything, from friends to belief systems, to your relationship with God, that is, me. You feel so separate from me that you imagine I won't even talk to you. And so you are required to deny the veracity of your own experience. You experience that you and I are one, but you refuse to believe it. Thus, you are separate not only from each other, but from your own truth.
Whoa, how can a person be separate from his or her own truth?
By ignoring it, by seeing it and denying it, or by changing it, twisting it, contorting it to fit a preconceived notion you have about what must be so. Take the question with which you started off here. You asked, is there life on other planets? I answered, of course.
I said, of course, because the evidence is so obvious. It is so obvious that I'm surprised you even asked the question. Yet this is how a person can be separate from his own truth, by looking truth in the eye so squarely he can't miss it, and then denying what he sees. Denial is the mechanism here. And nowhere is denial more insidious than in self-denial. You've spent a lifetime denying who and what you really are. It would be sad enough if you limited your denials to less personal things, such as your depletion of the ozone layer, your rape of old-growth forests, your horrible treatment of your young. But you're not content with denying all that you see around you. You won't rest until you deny all that you see within you as well. You see goodness and compassion within you, but you deny it. You see wisdom within you, but you deny it. You see infinite possibility within you, but you deny it. And you see and experience God within you, yet you deny it. You deny that I am within you, that I am you. And in this you deny me my rightful and obvious place.
I have not and do not deny you.
You admit that you are God?
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Exactly. And I tell you this, before the cock crows, you will deny me three times. By your very thoughts will you deny me. By your very words will you deny me. By your very actions will you deny me. You know in your heart that I am with you, in you, that we are one, yet you deny me. Or some of you say I exist, all right, but away from you, way out there somewhere. And the further away you imagine me to be, the further away you step from your own truth. As with so much else in life, from depletion of your planet's natural resources to the abuse of children in so many of your homes, you see it, But you don't believe it.
But why? Why? Why do we see and yet not believe?
Because you are so caught up in the illusion, you are so deep in the illusion that you cannot see past it. Indeed, you must not for the illusion to continue. This is the divine dichotomy. You must deny me if you are to continue seeking to become me. And that is what you are wanting to do. Yet you cannot become what you already are, so denial is important. It is a useful tool. Until it is not anymore. The Master knows that denial is for those who are choosing to have the illusion continue. Acceptance is for those who choose now for the illusion to end. Acceptance, proclamation, demonstration. Those are the three steps to God. Acceptance of who and what you really are. Proclamation of it for all the world to hear, and demonstration in every way. Self-proclamation is always followed by demonstration. You will demonstrate yourself to be God, even as you now demonstrate what you think of yourself. Your whole life is a demonstration of that. Yet with this demonstration will come your greatest challenge. For the moment you stop denying yourself, others will deny you. The moment you proclaim your oneness with God, others will proclaim your partnership with Satan. The moment you speak the highest truth, others will say you speak the lowest blasphemy. And as happens with all masters who gently demonstrate their mastery, you will be both worshipped and reviled, elevated and denigrated, honored and crucified. Because while for you the cycle will be over, those who are still living in the illusion will not know what to make of you.
Yet what will happen to me? I don't understand. I'm confused. I thought you've said over and over again that the illusion must go on, that the game must continue in order for there to be any game at all.
Yes, I have said that, and it does. The game does go on. Because one or two of you end the cycle of illusion, that does not end the game. Not for you, and not for the other players. The game is not ended until all in all becomes one again. Even then it is not ended. For in the moment of divine reunion, all with all, will the bliss be so magnificent, so intense, that I, we, you will literally burst wide open with gladness, exploding with joy, and the cycle will begin all over again. It will never end, my child. The game will never end, for the game is life itself, and life is who we are.
But what happens to the individual element, or part of all, as you call it, which rises to mastery, which achieves all-knowing?
That master knows that only his part of the cycle is complete. She knows that only her experience of the illusion has ended. Now the master laughs because the master sees the master plan. The master sees that even with her completion of the cycle, the game goes on. The experience continues. The master then also sees the role he may now play in the experience. The master's role is to lead others to mastery. And so the master continues to play, but in a new way and with new tools. For seeing the illusion allows the master to step outside of it. This the master will do from time to time when it suits his purpose and pleasure. Thus she proclaims and demonstrates her mastery, and he is called God Goddess by others. When all in your race are led to mastery and achieve it, then your race as a whole, for your race is a whole, will move easily through time and space. You will have mastered the laws of physics as you understood them, and you will seek to assist those belonging to other races and other civilizations in coming to mastery as well.
Even as those of other races and other civilizations are doing so now with us?
Exactly. Precisely.
And only when all the races of all the universe have achieved mastery.
Or, as I would put it, only when all of me has known the oneness.
Will this part of the cycle end?
You've put it wisely. For the cycle itself will never end.
Because the very ending of this part of the cycle is the cycle itself.
Bravo! Magnifico! You have understood. So yes, there is life on other planets, and yes, much of it is more advanced than your own.
In what way? You never really did answer that question.
Yes, I did. I said in every way. Technologically, politically, socially, spiritually, physically, psychologically.
Yes, but give me some examples. Those are statements so broad that they are meaningless to me.
You know, I love your truth. It's not everyone who would look God in the eye and announce that what he is saying is meaningless.
So, what are you going to do about it?
Exactly. You have exactly the right attitude. Because, of course, you're right. You can challenge me, confront me, and call me into question as much as you want, and I'm not going to do a damn thing. I may, however, do a blessed thing. Such as I'm doing here with this dialogue. Is this not a blessed event?
Yes, yes it is. And many people have been helped by this. Millions of people are being touched by this.
I know that. It's all part of the master plan. The plan for how you become masters.
You knew from the beginning that this trilogy would become a massive success, didn't you?
Of course I did. Who do you suppose has made it such a success? Who do you imagine has caused those people who are hearing this to have found their way to it? I tell you this. I know every person who will come to this material. And I know the reason each has been brought. And so do they. Now the only question is, will they deny me again?
Does it matter to you?
Not in the least. All my children will one day come back to me. It is not a question of whether, but of when. And so it may matter to them. Therefore, let those who have ears to hear listen.
Yes. Well, we were talking about life on other planets, and you were about to give me some examples of how it is so much more advanced than life on Earth.
Technologically, most other civilizations are far ahead of you. There are those which are behind you, so to speak, but not many. Most are far ahead of you.
In what way? Give me an example.
Okay. The weather. You don't seem able to control it. You can't even accurately predict it. You are therefore subject to its whims. Most worlds are not. The beings on most planets can control the local temperature, for example.
They can. I thought temperature on a planet was a product of its distance from the sun, its atmosphere, so forth.
Those things establish the parameters. Within those parameters, much can be done.
How so? In what way?
By controlling the environment, by creating or failing to create certain conditions in the atmosphere. You see, it is not only a matter of where you are in relationship to a sun, but what you place between yourself and that sun. You have placed the most dangerous things in your atmosphere and taken out some of the most important. Yet you are in denial about this. That is, most of you will not admit it. Even when the finest minds among you prove beyond doubt the damage you are doing, you will not acknowledge it. You call the finest minds among you crazed and say that you know better. Or you say that these wise people only have an axe to grind, a point of view to validate, and their own interests to protect. Yet it is you who are grinding an axe. It is you who are seeking to validate a point of view. And it is you who are protecting your special interests. And your chief interest is yourself. Every evidence, no matter how scientific, no matter how demonstrable or compelling, will be denied if it violates your self-interest.
That's a rather harsh statement. I'm not even sure it's true.
Really? Now you're calling God a liar?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way, exactly.
Do you know how long it has taken your nations to agree to simply stop poisoning the atmosphere with fluorocarbons?
Yes, well...
Well, nothing. Why do you suppose it took so long? Never mind, I'll tell you. It took so long because to stop the poisoning would cost many major companies a great deal of money. It took so long because it would cost many individual people their conveniences. It took so long because for years many people and nations chose to deny, needed to deny, the evidence in order to protect their interest in the status quo, in keeping things the way they are. Only when the rate of skin cancers increased alarmingly. Only when the temperatures began rising and the glaciers and snows began melting and the oceans got warmer and the lakes and rivers began flooding did more of you begin paying attention. Only when your own self-interest demanded it. Did you see the truth that your finest minds had been placing before you for years?
Well, what's wrong with self-interest? I thought you said in Book 1 that self-interest was the place to start.
I did, and it is. Yet in other cultures and other societies on different planets, the definition of self-interest is much larger than it is on your world. It is very clear to enlightened creatures that what hurts one hurts the many, and that what benefits the few must benefit the many, or ultimately it benefits no one. On your planet, it is just the opposite. What hurts one is ignored by the many, and what benefits the few is denied the many. This is because your definition of self-interest is very narrow, barely reaching past the individual being to his loved ones, and to those only when they do his bidding. Yes, I said in Book 1 that in all relationships, do what is in the best interests of the self. But I also said that when you see what is in your highest self-interest, you will see that it is that which is also in the highest interest of the other. For you and the other are one. You and all others are one. And this is a level of knowingness that you have not attained. You're asking about advanced technologies, and I tell you this. You cannot have advanced technologies in any beneficial way without advanced thinking. Advanced technology without advanced thought creates not advancement but demise. You've already experienced that on your planet, and you are very nearly about to experience it again.
Whoa, wait a minute. What do you mean? What are you talking about?
I'm saying that once before, on your planet, you had reached the heights, beyond the heights, really, to which you now are slowly climbing. You had a civilization on Earth more advanced than the one now existing, and it destroyed itself. Not only did it destroy itself, it nearly destroyed everything else as well. It did this because it did not know how to deal with the very technologies it had developed. Its technological evolution was so far ahead of its spiritual evolution that it wound up making technology its god. The people worshipped technology and all that it could create and bring, and so they got all that their unbridled technology brought, which was unbridled disaster. They literally brought their world to an end.
This all happened here, on this Earth?
Yes.
Are you talking about the lost city of Atlantis?
Some of you have called it that.
And Lemuria, the land of Mu?
That is also part of your mythology.
So then it is true. We did get to that place before.
Oh, beyond it, my friend. Way beyond it.
And we did destroy ourselves.
Why are you surprised? You're doing the same thing now.
I know we are. Will you tell us how we can stop?
There are many other books devoted to this subject. Most people ignore them.
Well, give us one title. I promise you we won't ignore it.
Read The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight.
By a man named Tom Hartman. Yes, I love that book.
Good. This messenger is inspired. Bring this book to the attention of the world.
I will.
It says everything that I would say here in answer to your last question. There's no need for me to rewrite that book through you. It contains a summary of many of the ways in which your Earth home is being damaged and ways that you can stop the ruination.
So far, what the human race has been doing on this planet is not very smart. In fact, throughout this dialogue, you've described our species as primitive. Ever since you first made that remark, I've been wondering what it must be like living in a non-primitive culture. You say there are many such societies or cultures in the universe.
Yes.
How many?
Oh, a great many.
Dozens? Hundreds?
Thousands.
Thousands? There are thousands of advanced civilizations?
Yes, and there are other cultures more primitive than yours.
What else marks a society as either primitive or advanced?
The degree to which it implements its own highest understandings. This is different from what you believe. You believe that a society should be called primitive or advanced based on how high its understandings are. But what good are the highest understandings if you do not implement them? The answer is they're no good at all. Indeed, they are dangerous. It is the mark of a primitive society to call regression progress. Your society has moved backward, not forward. Much of your world demonstrated more compassion 70 years ago than it does today.
Some people are going to have a hard time hearing this, you know. You say you're a non-judgmental God, yet some people may feel judged and made wrong all over the place here.
We've been over this before. If you say you want to go to Seattle and you're actually driving to San Jose, is the person of whom you're asking directions being judgmental if you're told you're heading in a direction that won't get you where you say you want to go?
Calling us primitive is not simply giving us directions. The word primitive is pejorative.
Really? And yet you say you so admire primitive art, and certain music is often savored for its primitive qualities, to say nothing of certain women.
You're using wordplay now to change things around.
Not at all. I'm merely showing you that primitive is not necessarily pejorative. It is your judgment that makes it so. Primitive is merely descriptive. It simply says what is true. A certain thing is in the very early stages of development. It says nothing more than that. It says nothing about right or wrong. You add those meanings. I have not made you wrong here. I have merely described your culture as primitive. That would only sound wrong to you if you have a judgment about being primitive. I have no such judgment. Understand this. An assessment is not a judgment. It is merely an observation of what is. I want you to know that I love you. I have no judgments about you. I look at you and see only beauty and wonder.
Like that primitive art.
Precisely. I hear your melody and I feel only excitement.
As with primitive music.
You're understanding me now. I feel the energy of your race as you would the energy of a man or woman of primitive sensuality. And like you, I am aroused. Now that is what is true about you and me. You do not disgust me. You do not disturb me.